You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand. Still,
trying to get up that great big hill of hope for a destination. I realized quickly when I knew I should that the world was made up of this brotherhood of man.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Four Non-Blondes, doing What's Up, introducing our show today. And we'll talk with Andrew Lichterman about the recent agreement between the United States and India that gives India access to United States nuclear technology in return for inspections of its civilian nuclear facilities. We'll also hear from Poet Laureate Mary Rudge on poetry, poets, and spreading peace internationally. With a vote count of 83-16, the U.S. Congress ended India's three-decades-long nuclear isolation in favor of an Indo-U.S. civilian nuclear agreement. The deal enables American companies to sell nuclear reactors, fuel, and technology to India after a ban of more than three decades of such trade. Critics say the deal allows India to expand its nuclear power industry without requiring it to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty as other nations must. With me today for a closer look at what all this means is Andrew Lichterman, a lawyer and policy analyst with Western States Legal Foundation. Welcome, Andrew Lichterman.
Good day.
It's great to have you with us. And yes, at the surface of it, it looks like this is just about nuclear energy and nuclear trade. But in fact, your research has pointed out much, much deeper roots.
Yes, it has. And first of all, I should provide a little bit of context. My view of the U.S.-India nuclear agreement is shaped by decades of work in grassroots peace and disarmament movements here in the United States. And so I tend not to think about issues of this kind in terms of the supposed interest of entire countries, of nation states as actors, but rather about the interests of particular groups or interests within those countries. And looking at it this way, it's clear that the U.S.-India nuclear deal is part of a far larger set of developing relationships between powerful elements in both the United States and India. In addition to the nuclear agreement, the governments of the U.S. and India have announced plans to increase cooperation and trade in a number of areas. These include military cooperation with the potential for U.S. arms sales to India and joint production of weapons, and also cooperation in broader aerospace and other technology research. And there are also developing relationships and agreements in areas of trade ranging from agriculture to retail to the financial industries. And so from my perspective, the key question is, what does this set of developing relationships, one which will intensify trade in high-tech weapons and nuclear technology and open up trade in other areas, mean for the rest of us? And will it make the world safer or more dangerous? Which factions or interests in both countries will be bound together more closely if this agreement goes forward? And what kind of a future economic and political path is this likely to reinforce?
When did this start?
Well, really, there has been a developing and closer relationship between the United States and India, stretching back almost a decade now. And in particular, if you're looking at this set of agreements, you have to at least go back to 2005, when the U.S.-India nuclear deal was entered into in principle, when it was first agreed to by the governments. There was then a fairly long process that it had to go through to receive initial approval in the United States Congress, which it did with the passage of the Hyde Act in 2006. And then it went through other institutions. The U.S. and India went. India went to the International Atomic Energy Agency to negotiate a set of safeguards agreements that would open up part, not all, but part of India's nuclear complex to inspection, the civilian nuclear sector. And then after that, just this past summer, it was brought to the Nuclear Suppliers Group, which was the organization formed, ironically, after India tested a nuclear weapon in 1974, using in large part technology that it had obtained from other countries, supposedly for civilian nuclear uses. India went to the nuclear suppliers group to obtain a waiver from them allowing nuclear trade, allowing it to, in particular, obtain fuel for its civilian nuclear power reactors on international markets. And again, one of the largest criticisms of this deal is that because India has fairly scarce domestic uranium, if it can buy fuel for its reactors on international markets, it will then be able to devote its domestic uranium to expanding its nuclear arsenal.
Well, India at this point has 14 nuclear reactors in commercial operation and 9 under construction, right? But it has a huge thorium reserve, about 25% of the world's total. So what does that mean, that it has thorium but not uranium?
Well, one of the arguments that the Indian nuclear technology sector, their domestic sector, has been making for a long time is that eventually they will be able to develop reactors that use thorium, and that this will provide them with a source of energy that will be very large for many, many decades. But so far, those reactors have not been developed. And it's important to get some perspective. Right now, India provides about 3% of its domestic electricity using nuclear power. That's only about 1% of its total energy production. Really, looking at it realistically, there's very little chance they will be able to do better than to double or triple the amount of energy generated with nuclear power over the next several decades. So many of the arguments that this will provide a major solution to global warming problems, or that this will provide a major energy boost for the bulk of India's population, many of whom live in rural areas in a agrarian economy, many of whom are beyond the reach even of the electric power grid. These arguments have been greatly exaggerated. And getting back, however, to the set of agreements that were entered into in 2005. So you had, first of all, this agreement on nuclear trade. But at the same time, about a month earlier, actually, you had an agreement for a new framework for the U.S.-India defense relationship that encompassed cooperation between the two militaries on joint exercises and various types of defense cooperation, the possibility of the U.S. Selling high-tech weapon systems to India, and in fact, just this past spring, U.S. companies tendered offers for 126 new fighter aircraft that India is planning to acquire. And you also had various agreements to increase the level of economic cooperation on other fronts. And these received far less attention. So, for example, you had an agreement to establish a CEO forum, a chief executive officers forum.
Andrew, this is a lot to digest. Where is this all heading?
Well, where it's all heading is an extremely difficult question to ask in terms of predictions. It's somewhat easier in terms of where these powerful interests that are driving the deal would like to see it go. And the answer to that is they want to see more of the same. They want to see the same kind of development path that the United States in particular has been leading the world through over the last several decades, because again, what this set of deals does is to bind elites with similar kinds of corporate interests, similar types of strategies for getting a privileged wealth stream from the rest of society. And what we're seeing is these groups trying to bind themselves more tightly to one another and their respective countries to this same development path that we're on. And this will have a number of consequences. For one thing, it continues to be a path that just presumes that unlimited growth is good, and as a consequence, is almost certainly not ecologically sustainable over a long period of time. It's a path that over the last decade, actually over the last several decades, has led to an increasing polarization of wealth, both within the United States and also globally. And if you start looking at the effects of this polarization of wealth around the world, one of the things that you see is that the fastest growing urban population segment in the world is in the vast ring slums around cities in large portions of the post-colonial world. And once again, this is a symptom of this two-tier economy where you have most of the economic activity of these huge organizations that dominate the economy in our everyday lives focused on buying and selling increasing quantities of goods and services to each other and to their upper echelon employees, with, you know, much of the rest of the world not only not able to afford to buy these products, but also being pushed off the best arable land in order to produce luxury crops for export, you know, to give people summer in the northern hemisphere, summer vegetables all year round, being driven off lands that have mineral resources under them, and so forth. And so where it's all going, if these constellations of large organizations, the corporations and the sectors of government that are their allies, have their way, is towards a path that gives us more of the same. And when you start looking at the military aspects of the relationship between India and the United States and the intentions of the agreements entered into in 2005 for increased military cooperation. The United States, U.S. military planners see India as a potential partner in Asia and talk about it as a counterbalance to China, for example. And you have Ashley Tellis, who was one of the people in the government who was one of the strongest and really most skilled advocates for the deal within the government bureaucracy. You know, he talks about India's nuclear arsenal as a potential counterbalance for China's nuclear arsenal. And you step back and you look at this in the broader global context. You have this growing global financial crisis that is clearly linked, although there can be a lot of argument about how exactly it's linked, to this two-tier economy, the accumulation of most of the wealth at the top, the great polarization of wealth that we're seeing, leading to these vast pools of capital sloshing back and forth, you know, seeking high returns rather than investing in, for example, transportation infrastructure, and a new energy economy that's both ecologically sustainable and that serves a much larger portion of the global population. You see us moving towards some kind of a global crisis. You see increasing militarization with a resurgence of tensions between the United States and Russia. You have Russia talking about beginning to modernize their nuclear arsenal. And more of the same in this context looks more and more dangerous as time goes on. We have a global context where you have the dominant economic power, the United States, still extremely powerful, with a very powerful conventional military and the world's most advanced nuclear arsenal, but clearly on the downslope, and now facing a grave economic crisis. You have rising economic powers like China and India. And you have all of this in the context of both new challenges in terms of resource limits and ecological deterioration that we've really never faced before. And all of this is occurring in a world where the major players this time around have nuclear weapons. And one of the real problems is the analysis of how all of this fits together generally isn't getting done. I mean, one of the things that was most interesting and frustrating about the way that the U.S.-India deal went down in the United States is when the vote was finally taken last week, it did less well in the Senate than from the perspective of the arms control and disarmament groups opposing it. It did less well in the Senate than the Henry Hyde Act, which was the initial congressional approval, had done 2 years before. We'd basically lost ground. And one thing I should stress is this is just my personal opinion, but I thought that the leading national arms control and disarmament groups that worked on this, for example, the Arms Control Association, did a really good job in terms of analyzing the nonproliferation aspects of the deal, in terms of getting out information that was timely and accessible and understandable about what the deal was and what its likely impacts were in terms of allowing India to expand its arsenal and what the relationship of this all was to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. I really thought their material was consistently good and consistently useful. And so the problem is not that the strategies that we've been pursuing were not done well enough. The problem is we're probably pursuing the wrong strategies. And we have to start putting together some kind of an approach to the disarmament issues that link them much more closely to the broader movements, not only in the United States, but worldwide, for a economy and a way of life that's more ecologically sustainable, and for an economy that's more fair and more democratically controlled.
Do you think that the average person in the United States, if there is such a creature, understands what is going on here? I think on the one hand, we hear a conversation about alternative energy, for example, and we assume that our leaders just haven't caught up yet, that it's a question of, you know, the people are doing it, but the leaders are not figuring out how to respond to the people yet. But in fact, what you're saying, it's completely opposite, that the leaders are actually working on a different plan altogether and working with a different worldview.
When you're saying leaders, you mean national leaders and the people who have the most power and influence in the world. Yeah, I think they're definitely pursuing a whole different vision of what the future should look like. Certainly than, for example, the disarmament groups are, or the groups pushing alternative energy are. One of the first things you really have to do is take apart the big abstractions. For example, if you're talking about so-called national security issues or disarmament issues, there's a tendency to talk about one policy or another, whichever policy the speaker happens to be advocating at the time, as better advancing U.S. interests or the national interests. Well, there isn't any single U.S. interest or national interest. That's pretty much an empty set. And you have to really start looking at it and saying, okay, what kind of foreign policy for the United States benefits different sectors of the population. Again, you see the United States pushing this foreign policy that has propagated the neoliberal development model globally, that tends to benefit this particular set of large organizations, of large corporations, and we really have to be asking the question, you know, who is really benefiting here? And it's complicated because if you look where the United States stands globally in terms of the income of its population, you know, roughly the top 80% of the U.S. population stands above all but the top 10 or 15% of the population in India, for example. And so it can be, of course, a very hard sell for people in the United States to start thinking, hey, wait a minute, maybe I should be looking at a more modest future for myself, and maybe in the long term, my interests have more in common with somebody who's in the middle or the lower end of the income distribution in a country like India than it is with the top 5 to 10% of the country that I live in. But one of the things I think we're going to start finding out with this financial crisis is you know, which interests really are in common.
I want to remind our listeners that you're with Raising Sand Radio, and we're talking today with Andrew Lichterman, policy analyst at the Western States Legal Foundation. Andrew, what is a good way for us to think about this?
One of the things that's has sort of exacerbated our difficulty, certainly my difficulty, in understanding how all of this fits together, has been the increased focus here in the United States over the last several decades on a politics that's very much oriented towards the center, towards national politics, again, towards these big abstractions of what's the national interest and the economy and so forth. And paradoxically, at the same time, of course, the fragmentation of progressive political work into an array of single-issue focused groups. And all of this makes it more difficult to understand how the big picture fits together. And for me, one of the real solutions is to try to kind of turn politics right side up once again and focus on building our social movements at the local and regional level. Again, over the last 20 years or so, you know, the progressive forces in this country have been, to a certain degree, operating off of movements and institutions that were built decades ago. And far less time and energy has been put into keeping our local and regional organizations alive than has been put into an increasingly professionalized kind of network of national, more top-down, more professionalized and lobbying-centered kinds of organizations. And one of the other things about really starting to think about these issues on the local level is it often, first of all, gives us a much more concrete understanding about how these issues play themselves out in the economy and in our everyday lives. I mean, for example, here in the Bay Area in the 1980s, there was a long struggle over whether or not the Navy would base a large number of ships, many of them carrying nuclear cruise missiles, here in San Francisco Bay. And it was, over the course of the years, a campaign that brought together environmental groups and nuclear disarmament groups and groups that were concerned about intervention in Central America, and got people thinking about what were the connections between all of these issues. And it also soon brought in, on both sides of the issues, both for and against, elements of the labor movement, because on the one hand, it was involved a huge amount of construction at Bay Area Navy bases that would have provided jobs for certain sectors of the labor movement, but at the same time, they were going to bring in non-union labor from out of state to do certain other aspects of the work, which evoked a fair amount of opposition to the plan from other sectors of the labor movement. And the point is that what it did was to bring these big issues, you know, what kind of a military are we going to have, and what are its purposes? What are the effects of an economy that spends so much on its military, and how does that, you know, what does that mean as a development choice for a particular region? All of these issues, first of all, become more concrete for people on this level, but also the hard questions, you know, the peace movement talking to the labor movement about something that looks like it's going to generate a large number of jobs, you are much more likely to be able to develop some kind of a politics, to begin to develop some kind of a politics that can develop a vision of an alternative path forward, some kind of a different economy, an economy that's not dependent on military contracting, an economy that is takes a different path forward in terms of its transportation infrastructure and energy and so forth, when you are focusing on these issues on a local level and when people really are talking to each other about the issues that affect their jobs and their lives and the shape of their community. So all of these reasons really should push us towards turning our attention again to reviving the strength of our local organizations that work on these issues and trying to think about what kind of coalitions we should be forming to move forward.
Well, Andrew Lichterman, we've talked about things in some depth today, and we would like people to know more about this, but I'm going to ask you how people should proceed.
Really, I can only speak for the portion of the social movements that I've been working in for the last several decades, and the kind of work I've been doing, which is peace and disarmament work. And really, we need to do more thinking. In disarmament work, we need to focus more of our time and attention and more of our discussion on really understanding the interests that are driving the continued commitment to nuclear weapons and to the constant accumulation of all kinds of high-tech weapons within each nuclear-armed state and globally. And we need to identify the actual interests and alliances, the organizations and the sectors of the population that continue to benefit from high-tech militarism and from the retention or acquisition of nuclear weapons in particular. And really, most important, we need to figure out the role that disarmament work best can play in building broader social movements for global economic equity and an ecologically sustainable way of life. I believe that this kind of work and these kinds of movements are the best way to create the political conditions in which disarmament may become possible, and to make wars, including those involving nuclear-armed states, less likely in the meantime.
That was Andrew Lichterman, a policy analyst with Western States Legal Foundation, and you can contact Andrew Lichterman through Western States Legal Foundation, which is based in Oakland, California. Before we turn to the poetry of peace with Mary Rudge, I have an update on the capital punishment case of Troy Davis. Regular listeners heard a recent interview with Daryl Myers on the death penalty and Troy Davis's execution, which was then scheduled for September 23rd in Atlanta, Georgia. Troy Davis is a black man accused of killing white police officer Mark MacPhail in 1989. 7 of the 9 witnesses against Davis recanted, saying that they were threatened and coerced by police. The execution was scheduled 6 days before Davis's appeal was to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. There was an enormous groundswell of outrage from around the world, and the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles delayed the execution. On October 14th, 3 weeks after temporarily sparing Davis from the death penalty, the United States Supreme Court declined to hear his appeal. This decision will probably lead to a quick execution, although Mr. Davis has faced imminent execution twice before, once on July 27th of this year and again on September 23rd, which raises the question of how the Eighth Amendment defines cruel and unusual punishment. and this is something we will examine in a future show. About Troy Davis, Southern Regional Director for Amnesty International, Jared Fuhr, said he was shocked and saddened by the Supreme Court's action. This decision, he says, shows how flawed and immoral the death penalty is. The court had been asked to rule on the basic question of guilt and innocence and the constitutional right of an individual to not be executed when there is any doubt of his guilt. The court in this case ducked its obligation. Raising Sand will keep you updated as the story unfolds. Staying with the justice system, let's take a quick look at elections, voting, and the United States prisons. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, in New York, nearly 62,300 of the record 115,573 people convicted of felony offenses in 2007 probably think that they have forever lost the right to vote. This is not the case. Convicted felons who have served their time and finished their parole can vote in many states. In New York, State Assemblyman Nick Perry of the 58th District of Kings County is sponsoring Legislative Bill A-417, which would require the Divisions of Criminal Justice Services to notify former inmates that their right to vote has been restored within 30 days prior to their release, and require voter registration forms to be provided to these individuals. At the federal level, the Democracy Restoration Act of 2008, that is DRA S6340 or HR 7136, was introduced in both chambers of Congress last week by Senator Russ Feingold and Representative John Conyers, that would restore the right to vote in federal elections to individuals who were previously convicted of a crime, have completed their prison terms, and are living in the community. Let's turn now to poet laureate Mary Rudd, sharing her experiences presenting poetry and performance art for peace around the world and how this art is received.
Normally, when I go to a country to speak, I like to bring in the culture heroes who have been for peace. Almost every country has a record of how poets created peace in their country. In Ireland, for instance, they developed a underground language, a symbolic language, so they could communicate that one word would mean something else.
When they were being oppressed,
well,
by the British?
even until now, too. Oh, okay. But mostly that's when it developed, uh-huh. Is that they had ways to refer to their issues by names. And this is true even in China today, where you might not want to speak out. You might feel a little repressed when you're there, but...
Have you been to... Was China one of the countries?
Five times.
Oh.
But when you go there, if you say a word, even though they might not understand your accent very well, but if you say Xuyan, they all know that he's the poet who drowned himself in the Milo River as a protest against social and political injustice. So if you want to talk about social or political injustice, you just say the name of this poet, and people laugh, or they know what you mean. It's a secret language. So I like to talk about Li Po, maybe a big myth, but it's a one that I love. He was a court poet in China. And he became alcoholic, so for safety's sake, he left the court because he didn't think he could control his language. But he had such wonderful control of language when he was in the position that when someone sent a message to the emperor declaring war, and he didn't want war, he gave this scroll to his poet Li Po to answer, because he knew the poet had a way with words. And with just a few brush strokes, Li Po changed the characters so that this message was not one of war but one of peace, and that same scroll was rolled up and sent back to the sender, who said, why should we kill these intelligent people? Let's make friends. And war was averted. That's a wonderful story.
It is a wonderful story.
And I know in ancient Ireland, the king would always be placed between two poets, because people could kill kings, they could be replaced, but the mind of the poet was so impressive. They remembered all the genealogy, and they could say all the words of praise and bring people together. So they didn't want to kill the poet. So to protect the king, they put the poets on either side of the king. So with the women I've known too, a lot of them have to find ways to communicate. They don't get invited to be in politics as, until recently. And they would come out and say what needed to be said politically as a song or as a poem.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about this being the 88th anniversary of the women getting the right to vote in the United States. That's not a very long time, but even given that, almost 90 years, we've only just now seen women reach some kind of political power, and it's almost sometimes disappointing to see how they are taking on characteristics that one would not really expect. I'm thinking specifically of Hillary saying, Hillary Clinton, when she was running for president, saying that we will obliterate the Iranians, as if that was just something you can throw off without realizing that you're talking about killing millions of civilians.
Well, no, that's so inhumane. And when you look at what our grandmothers did to get the vote, I'm sure that they didn't intend for women to use their vote to perpetuate war. I believe that they had something different in their own mind. They had peaceable demonstrations, but they were not treated peaceably. They were arrested for obstructing the sidewalk. They were put in prison, in jail. They tried to find ways to say they were insane so they could permanently institutionalize some of them. And the doctors refused, at least in one instance that I, that's recorded, the doctor refused to give that kind of a pronunciation for the women, saying that when women show courage, they're frequently judged insane.
Or witches.
Or abnormal. Yeah, or out of their place, you know.
Right.
This is not their place. But I believe that the women had to suffer so hard to get the vote. We have to be very careful how we use it. We have to actually use it. Women must vote because of what went down to get justice for women. It's not just in our grandmother's day, it goes way back to ancient times. You know, Queen Esther in the Bible, in the Old Testament, had to take, you know, enormous stands to get justice for her her people. Lady Godiva, you know, tried to get the taxes lowered for the suffering people, and, you know, her husband said, well, you know, I'll lower the taxes the day you ride naked through the streets. And she did.
Did he lower the taxes?
Yes, absolutely.
He's a man of his word.
Absolutely, yeah. So when you put into the context what women have done to get the vote or to influence, to get justice, well, we have to honor that by using our vote. I'd like to read you a poem by the poet laureate of Point Arena, Fiona Perkins. Listing my chores for the day, the decade, the next century, I note that the planet needs saving. By screaming, I suppose, out on the street like a rabid banshee, hoisting a placard, shaking a fist, when I'd rather ride by in a carriage, smiling, and doing my queen wave. I hate being jostled by bodies, roared at, hassled, arrested, going limp in debris. A disgrace to my mother, a public nuisance, how often I'm told, and at times I agree. If ever a man did as he promised, to cherish the ground I walked on, our earth, I'd never again stall his traffic and hear myself cursed. I'd rather be home in my garden pruning and pulling weeds. Yes, it's still the same as always. Whether warning the vote or wanting the vote or saving the world, stopping a war, needing a pay raise or care for the children, out in the street with my banners and bitches marching and going to jail.
And this is really a good poem for what's going on in the political world in the United States right now, isn't it?
Yes.
We watch women doing this all the time.
Carrying signs, asking for, referendums to be passed, anti-war messages given out. Well, it's not just war, it's hunger, it's housing, it's care for the street people, it's many, many issues, but they're all interconnected, and it does go back to financing war.
Mm-hmm.
It does go back to how the money's used.
Mm-hmm. And how the money's made. I mean, we make an enormous amount of money by financing war around the world, in fact.
Yeah, we use our wonderful resources for oil. I remember I was in a peace demonstration in San Francisco with a sign saying, a child in Iraq died for my car. I haven't had a car for a long time, but that's the psychology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have, if I had a car, I'd put the bumper sticker on it now that says, I'm already against the next war.
Mm-hmm.
So war is very, very crucial to this particular election. And oil, I suppose that the woman from Alaska who's on the ticket now has a lot to say about what's going to happen with the oil in Alaska. Well, you know, I hate to vote in people that may be puppets because we don't know how McCain has been persuaded to vote 90% of the time for the exact way that Bush voted.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have that track record down yet about how they will deal internationally in creating peace with words, not war. But we did hear something very negative from the Democrats, and yet the Democrats, I believe, were our hope in the sense that we need to put a different face on our country, look how we look to the rest of the world, and we need to show that minorities can really do what America says, that children can grow up to be president, that all people are equal. We need to, I go around the world, as I told you, in different countries with a performance group sometimes, and this performance group is very mixed. And they're all women. One's Chinese, one is Portuguese, one is African American, and a couple of mixed race. Uh-huh. When we show up in other countries where, okay, in China, everybody has the same skin coloring, more or less. I mean, they in Hungary, everybody has more or less the same physical cultural identity, mm-hmm. visual look. So when they see us, well, we really stand out.
Mm.
They say, oh, so that's what America looks like.
Oh, that's nice.
And then when they see how well we get along together, and they say, oh, it works.
Yeah.
They just had no concept before. They just didn't really see us before.
And, yeah.
You know, because this is not what they see on television. They see our violence. So when we go to other countries, people would come up and take our hands. Women put their arm around our shoulder and say, oh, your poor country. Oh, so violent. We pray for your country all the time.
Is that right?
That's absolutely true. Even when I was in Lourdes and was going down into the sacred water, you know, Bernadette was ordered to dig, and the water came up out of the ground, and it has supposedly cured many, many people, and people go there by the hundreds. And so when I was being lowered down into the water by the two women on either side of me who lowered me down and pulled me up, and they said, we're doing this for your country because we want peace.
Hmm. And that's actually a nice thing for you to say, because I know that it's not it's not something that a lot of Americans understand about themselves in this country. We're so isolated that we tend not to stand outside and look in and, and see what other people are seeing, because we think everything flows from us. So this is a, this is something that I'm pleased to be able to air, saying that you have people coming up to you saying, pray for, that they're praying for this country.
Right. If I were just there alone, they wouldn't understand the multicultural look that we have. So the advantage in going with the group is that they do get the multicultural look, and then that way they can say something that maybe they normally wouldn't say to me as a as an individual tourist. Also, we have the message that we give through our poetry and performance. The dancers create stage atmosphere and personas with what they wear and what they do. They have a they choreograph one of my poems. Maybe I could just read it. It's called For Women with Fringe Shawls. When we perform this one, just try to visualize all of these women dancing, okay, in fringe shawls, because women wear a shawl covered, you know, and they wear shawls in Greece and Mexico, and there are these, there are women who have to cover their hair, and so all of these, there's something about the shawl that is a shawl-covered woman was also one of the names for Ireland.
You know? Oh, really?
Yeah, the shawl-covered woman. When they couldn't say Ireland, they said, oh, the shawl-covered woman. But anyway, this is called For Women in Fringed Shawls. Knowing with shawls fringe sweeping the floor, how many years women have been sweepers of this world. Twigs tied on stick, brush, brush, the dirt the boys track in, sweep, sweep, the crumbs the men leave. I am proud to sweep this hall with these long fringes of my shawl. I am the woman poet, and sweep before me all women up to the podium, flutter and brush the air, this fringe. I know the fringes of men's worlds, where old poems sent women to sweep the sky with witch screech, screaming from brooms to tell the darkness their dreams. They would sweep the moon. Astronauts leave garbage for them there still, debris of mankind circling in place. You have an instinct for this broom, they said, and read how Cinderella swept right off his feet a prince, discovery to inspire sweeping all space. Cleanliness is next to godliness, I heard on Sunday. God's kingdom, as the princess, comes to me for my pure industry. Sweep, sweep the room. Broom, existential tool for women's primal work, would keep the earth. Sweep dead bats from cave. Her territory was a hearth, inheritance, ash. Who would believe imaginary world where women sweep out princes? Yes, those politicians, toads that let the babies starve and children sleep in the streets, flies on filth of their faces. Wrapped in this symbolic shawl, I, with long fringe sweeping, stride to the microphones and call on men in unswept White House, Castle, Pentagon. You who unfurl flags over your war's array for murder, some big mess to sweep up. Now you weep in secret how death's angel's feather-fringed wings fold on all men. See, I say, women with fingers, fringes, palms, ready around to hold you to life. I sweep the floor, the air clear for this vision, until you feel in the wind's fringe brush your face, your room, your world, soul. So, in this fringed shawl, I, you would send to sweep, have come to sweep the cobwebs from the skies, your eyes.
There was Poet Laureate of Alameda, California, Mary Rudge. And that's our show for today. Views expressed are those of the host and guests, and not KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for today's music goes to Four Non Blondes with What's Up, and we'll go out with Bob Marley, Get Up, Stand Up. Thanks for listening. Come back next week when we will share the artistry of warrior writers, poems, and prose of troops returned from war.
Get up, stand up, GGA, stand up for your right one more time. Get up, stand up, GGA. Get up, you stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. You get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. You get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. You get up. Hissing, skissing, trying to go to heaven in a hissing, skissing. We know and we understand. Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. Now you see the light. Stand up for your right. Give up.